Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. Some new developments in the impeachment inquiry today. Democrats have released transcripts of the testimonies given by former ambassador to Ukraine, Marie Yovanovitch, and Ambassador Michael McKinley, who was a senior advisor to the Secretary of State. Meanwhile, four Trump administration officials defied subpoenas to testify in Congress today. And House Intelligence Chair Adam Schiff told reporters that Democrats were moving forward anyway.
We're not going to delay our work. That would merely allow these witnesses and the White House to succeed with their goal, which is to delay, deny, obstruct.
Meanwhile, we got another decision in the long battle over the release of President Trump's tax returns. Let's bring in NPR White House reporter Ayesha Roscoe. Ayesha, what are we learning, first of all, from these transcripts that were released today of the testimonies of Yovanovitch and McKinley?
So these transcripts are just coming out. So we're still kind of pouring through them. But one thing that came out in Ambassador Yovanovitch's testimony is that she says that she was shocked by the transcript that was released of President Trump's call with the Ukrainian president. In that call, President Trump talked about Yovanovitch and called her bad news and said that she would be going through some things. And Yovanovitch said that she was shocked by it, that it felt almost like a threat to her, and that it really worried her, and that she didn't think that the president would be speaking about a U.S. diplomat or a former U.S. diplomat in that way.
Interesting. So we're still pouring through there. The reason, by the way, that these transcripts are so important is because the testimony thus far has been going on behind closed doors. There are Republicans in the room, but we've been kind of relying on leaks to find out what actually was said by some of the people who have been deposed. Meanwhile, there are four people that didn't show up today. What happened, and did they give any reasons for not testifying?
Yes. Essentially, they're raising concerns about the legitimacy of this process. The White House has argued that these subpoenas are not valid because the White House would not be able to have its own lawyer present for the deposition. And the White House is directing some of these officials to not appear. And these officials are saying that they have no choice but to comply with the White House request.
Well, let's talk about John Eisenberg, who was one of the four who didn't appear. He's the top lawyer for the National Security Council. And he is reportedly behind that effort to lock down records of President Trump's call to Zelensky in July. What do we know about Eisenberg?
Well, we know he's been with the administration pretty much from the beginning. My colleague, Franco Ordonez, he spoke with people who have worked with Eisenberg, and they described him as cautious and competent, someone who keeps a lot of detailed notes. They also called him very highly ethical. This is someone who has a math degree from Stanford, a law degree from Yale, and has been working. He's worked in other administrations like the George W. Bush Justice Department, but he was also the person who, at this point, who NSC officials came to with concerns about the way President Trump was handling Ukrainian policy. And so multiple witnesses have said they went to Eisenberg and raised concerns about the way the White House was handling its conduct toward Ukraine.
And Eisenberg, again, did not show up to testify today. What do you think's going on there? Because the Trump administration had said they didn't want to cooperate, but then we had witness after witness defy the White House's orders and actually come forward. And now all of a sudden we're back to they're not cooperating.
Well, I think the difference is in the nature of the people that are being called now. Some of these people are very close to the administration and are very close to the White House, or very close to different officials within the White House. And some of these are more political appointees. Before, you had people who were more career oriented or career staff. And so they weren't necessarily on the same track as some of these people. And some of them had already left. So they had less to lose. So if you're already out of the administration or on your way out, you are going to make different calculations than someone who's kind of deeply entrenched in the administration.
Do you think that we are going to hear from former National Security Advisor John Bolton, who is supposed to testify this week?
It's not likely, because Bolton has the same lawyer as his former NSC deputy, Charles Kupperman, and Kupperman has filed a federal lawsuit seeking a ruling on whether he must comply with the congressional request to appear or with the White House order to not appear. So since they have the same counsel, the thought is that Bolton will likely wait to see what the court rules for that case and basically who should they listen to.
Okay, meanwhile, just briefly here, the other story today, a federal appeals court ruling that the president's accounting firm must hand over his tax returns to the state of New York. The legal team for President Trump already says they'll appeal to the Supreme Court. What happens now?
So we'll be waiting to see if the Supreme Court will intervene and whether and, you know, will they take a stand on what happens in this case? And so it will be, this could have a lot of implications for the president.
That is NPR White House reporter Aisha Roscoe in Washington. Thank you.
Thank you.
President Trump signed a plan this weekend capping the number of refugees allowed in the United States next year at 18,000. That's down from the current limit of 30,000, and it's an historic low for the resettlement program. WHYY's Laura Binshoff reports on what's driving the limits and the people who have been arriving in Pennsylvania in recent years.
In August, Bohdan Krevsky moved to Bucks County, just north of Philadelphia, from the city of Lutsk, Ukraine. The 23-year-old evangelical Christian wasn't fleeing war or famine, but hostility towards his religious beliefs.
It's called post-Soviet syndrome, and there are still people who don't like our church, and their kids and grandkids have the same mentality.
That shows up as bullying in school, having a harder time finding a job, or even crackdowns on churches in some areas of the country. As the Trump administration has reduced arrivals from parts of the Middle East and Africa, Ukrainians are now one of the largest country groups arriving in the U.S. as refugees. Krevsky says what he likes about this country is that religious differences are protected by law.
Because when you come to the U.S., there's a law. There is no discrimination if you belong to a different religion.
President Trump has made a number of changes to U.S. refugee policy over the last 3 years. In 2017, for example, his administration added vetting procedures for refugees from 11 countries deemed to be high risk, including most of the countries blocked by the initial travel ban. As a result, refugee arrivals from places like Somalia, South Sudan, and Yemen plummeted. Where people come from is one change. How many is another. Mark Unger is regional director with Bethany Christian Services, which resettles refugees in Lancaster, Pennsylvania.
President Obama, his last year, there was 100,000 people coming in, and then immediately that was cut in half, and now it's now down to 30,000.
The White House has sweeping powers to expand or contract refugee arrivals by setting an annual cap. In 2020, that number will be 18,000 people, the lowest cap since the modern refugee resettlement program began in 1980. Prior to that, refugees came on a more ad hoc basis, an arrangement that grew from the mass displacement following World War II and the shame some Americans felt turning away Jews who'd been fleeing the Nazis. For supporters of refugees like Unger, the recent and dramatic cutbacks are a devastating reversal.
When you think of the number of people, displaced people in the world today, to think that we would turn our back and not respond to that need just doesn't sound like the United States that I know.
Supporters of Trump's immigration policies say they reflect just where the country should be heading. Roy Beck is director of a think tank that advocates for lower levels of immigration called Numbers USA.
I mean, certainly the numbers have come down, and we like that. But I'm not sure that the criteria being used for who get those a small number of refugee slots has been worked out that carefully yet.
Beck says only people fleeing imminent danger should be admitted into the U.S. refugee resettlement program. But from the point of view of American military leaders, the program isn't just about saving lives. It's also a strategic foreign policy, a way to convince people in countries where the U.S. has military operations to help efforts on the ground. Rezwan Natik and his family arrived in Philadelphia from Afghanistan earlier this year. He'd been working for the U.S. government, training Afghan bureaucrats at the Ministry of Justice. There, he survived three attacks by the Taliban, including one just after he arrived for work one morning.
When I left the security area, the explosion happened behind me. Four of the American guards were killed, so that was a mess.
It's so dangerous to work for the U.S. government in Iraq and Afghanistan that there's a special refugee channel for these allies. Some spots in next year's refugee quota are reserved for them. Natik told almost no one about his job working for the Americans and instead pretended to run a nonprofit organization trying to bring more educational opportunities to rural areas. He says he applied to become a refugee in the U.S. with a heavy heart.
I didn't want, honestly, my wife be a widowed woman and my child to be orphans.
He says he wishes he could have stayed in Afghanistan to help rebuild his country, but it's just not safe. For Here and Now, I'm Laura Benshoff.
This message comes from NPR sponsor MindBody. MindBody connects millions to the widest variety of local fitness classes, and they offer the same experience when it comes to massage and acupuncture, spas and salons. Find, book, and pay all in one place. Owners can join the network at mindbodyonline.com/NPR. MindBody, your access to the largest consumer wellness network and marketplace.
Can we affect the rise and fall of the economy?
Although things may look good for now, many Wall Street analysts are concerned about the warning signs ahead.
Just by the way we talk about it?
Once again, flashing that ominous recession.
How stories and psychology affect our economic fate. This week on Hidden Brain from NPR.
Okay, I'm going to share something with you. One of my first memories in life is of me, maybe 3 or 4 years old, sitting in the backseat of my mom's car and hearing Prince's song, Little Red Corvette, blasting from the radio. It made me feel strange in a way that also felt exciting. Really, this is the only way I can describe it. And I've been a super fan ever since. It's also the way our next guest felt about Prince. Dan Pipenbring was a huge Prince fan when in 2016, he got a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to co-write Prince's memoir with Prince. The two never finished. Prince died several months later. But Pipenbring used what Prince had written up, along with photos, handwritten notes, and other materials, to put together the book, The Beautiful Ones. Dan, welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you, Tanya. Really happy to be here.
Okay, so I couldn't do this segment without acknowledging how big of a fan I am. I think folks who know me would have a fit hearing me try to play it straight in this interview with you. But you were also a huge Prince fan, too, as I mentioned, when this opportunity to co-write this book presented itself. And at the time, you were with a publication, The Paris Review, and you had never written a memoir before. Why do you think Prince chose you?
That's a great question, and there's always going to be a little bit of mystery surrounding it, I think, because Prince, of course, is a mysterious man and not one who's liable to be so explicit about things like this. I think what maybe led him to embrace someone like me who had never done anything like this before was that I tried to be as open as possible to writing a book that was in no way going to be a conventional memoir. Of course, Prince, being a man of grand ambitions, could not settle for a mere autobiography. He wanted something that would break the mold of the genre and that would have people talking. And I think even more than that, that would inspire people, especially young black creatives, musicians, artists, to make art that they felt had no debt to anyone, that was truly one of a kind.
You know, one of the things that strikes me are the details Prince wrote for the book, the depths he went to paint this really detailed picture of his mother and father growing up, and more specifically, his relationship with them. I mean, for those who follow Prince, this is kind of significant because for so long there was this crafted image of him. I think the closest we got was the movie Purple Rain, which for a long time a lot of people actually thought was a true story. It was not.
Mm-hmm.
Why do you think he wanted to write about his parents at this time in his life?
I think, like many of us, as Prince grew older, he was more aware of himself as his parents' son. I think he really regarded his parents as the two poles of his being. They were always inside of him, both of them kind of competing for the primary role. So on one side, you have his father, a very disciplined man, dedicated with an unimpeachable work ethic. On the other hand, you have his mother, a much more spontaneous woman, someone who's almost irrepressibly free, who doesn't want anyone telling her what to do or why or when. You see both of these in Prince. I mean, that work ethic is absolutely there. When you think about the song, The Beautiful Ones, I've read that he recorded that song in a single 17-hour session. Mm-hmm. And he's recording all of the parts by himself. He's writing the lyrics. He's writing the music. He's doing the mixing. I don't think he could have done something like that without that part of his father and him really pushing him to keep at it. But when you hear the kind of emotion in it, the kind of unfettered emotion, that puts me in mind of his mother.
What's it gonna be, babe? Do you want him? Do you want me? 'Cause I want you.
This book is heavy, like it literally weighs like a pound.
It does. The paper's really thick. It's great for, you know, if you've got a burglar in the house, you know, just reach for the beautiful ones and you can.
Yeah, you know what to reach for. But was that intentional? Was there some sort of other symbol or reason for that beyond the beautiful pictures that are in the book?
I think we just wanted it to be an object that was worthy of having his name on the cover. And we needed to present these artifacts, for lack of a better word, in full color with as much kind of respect as we could surround them with. And I think because there is a kind of hole at the center of the book, this sort of beautiful question of what could have been, it's almost a book about a hypothetical book. It really had to have this majesty to it. Mm-hmm. He's royalty after all.
Yes. In addition to these descriptions of his childhood, there are also lots of musings about the music. For instance, in talking about the song Do Me Baby, he said, quote, "Everybody can point to at least one song that is their jam and nobody else's. The first time I knew I'd written one of those jams was Do Me Baby." Thinking back to his parents and what he had written about his parents, you'd also learn that his parents' divorce played a big role in shaping him and influenced his music as well.
Because his parents' divorce lived so strongly within him and really registered, I think, as one of the primary traumas of his life, he felt that he had this very ready access to heartbreak. And I remember him saying, because he could be very funny too, of course, he would mime receiving a phone call from someone like a butler or something who had just heard one of his breakup songs. And he'd say, well, sir, the flowers are dead. You've killed them. That was something he was very proud of. He could write a love song or a breakup song that would kill the flowers.
One thing that stood out to me that really comes through in this book, I don't even know if this is the right way to say it, but this sense of gender fluidity and Prince's appreciation for both the feminine and masculine energy within himself.
Yes.
I'm thinking about this time we're in now, where we're talking about defying gender roles. How did Prince, if at all, describe this to you?
Prince regarded himself as a man. He would always speak to me about his masculinity. I know that it was certainly imbued with large swaths of a feminine spirit, or what he would call the feminine principle, which he thought underlied every solid community that he had ever encountered. He felt that it was always the women in a community who were really looking out for one another, who had each other's backs. The masculine would be a much more competitive, testosterone-driven energy given to sundering things rather than uniting them. And you're right, I think he felt both of those within him. I do sometimes wonder, had he been born in 2019, for instance, would he have been what we call gender fluid? But to my mind, he was always a man, just one with an unusually acute sense of the feminine and a real gift, I think, for crossing a bound that too many men are reluctant to cross.
Yeah, I think he said in the book to you, or he had written that he always feels at ease if there's a woman in the room.
That's right. And even when he would ask me to transcribe these pages he had written, he was like, well, if you're not going to do it yourself, I would prefer that you get a woman to do it. Really, that's another reason why I didn't think I was going to get the job, that I wasn't a woman. Mm. You know, I was just a 29-year-old white guy from Brooklyn. It seemed like on every possible level, it wasn't going to be me. So I try never to predict what Prince would do or say or think or feel, because he really was unpredictable in that way.
There were so many questions you had that you didn't have a chance to answer. When you talked to Prince about his memoir, he also mentioned his performance at the Super Bowl halftime show in 2007 as something he wanted to include in the book. That obviously didn't happen. But what parts of his life do you particularly maybe wish you could have explored with him?
That's certainly one of them. I know that he regarded that Super Bowl show as a kind of summit, or maybe a return to a summit he had been to before. And to see him playing Purple Rain in the Rain, I mean, it did seem like an almost divine moment. So, of course, I would have wanted to ask him about that. And of course, the death of his child, too. He and his first wife, Maite, lost a child when the baby was only a few days old. I've always wondered what he made of it. To me, it seems like the great kind of unprocessed event of his life, something that must have been just utterly wrenching to him. And I just wondered, after so many years had passed, what he would make of it. That's one of many things that I wish I could have gotten him on the record about.
Dan Pippenbring is the editor of the new Prince memoir, The Beautiful Ones. Dan, thank you.
Thank you.
This message comes from NPR's sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
While trade talks with the U.S. remain stalled, China is already pivoting to a massive trade deal with Southeast Asian countries. It's called the Regional Comprehensive Economic Partnership, or RCEP. It is a free trade agreement involving 10 Southeast Asian countries, as well as 6 other countries, including Australia and New Zealand. Joining us now is Jill Schlesinger, business analyst with CBS News and host of Jill on Money. Hi, Jill.
Hello.
So this deal has been in the works since 2011, but today Thailand announced that it will be signed sometime early next year. Remind us who's involved with this and what it would do.
So as you said, a lot of the countries you mentioned, but also China, really big, Japan, Singapore, South Korea, Vietnam. This is a big block. It covers nearly half of the global population and just about a third of the world's gross domestic product. Now, the deal is basically a chance for China to help integrate Asia's economies. Supposedly, we're going to get new market access for goods and services in this agreement, some investment opportunities. Officials said the pact would create what they called an open, inclusive, and rules-based international trading system.
But it doesn't include the U.S. at a time when the U.S. and China are in the middle of a trade war.
Yeah, and I think that this is kind of interesting. China has absolutely led the way on this deal, and I think China itself sees it as an important piece in integration, especially as negotiations with the Trump administration over trade really stalled, and maybe they're going to get a deal with the U.S., but right now China is certainly contending with the pressure that that trade war has created on its own economy, but also the Trump administration's pressure on other Asian nations to shun Chinese infrastructure loans and 5G technology.
And of course, the U.S. did have a strategy for staying economically engaged with the Asia Pacific. It was called the Trans-Pacific Partnership. President Trump pulled out of that in 2017. How does the RCEP compare to the TPP?
Well, TPP was really a bigger deal, right? Because it accounted for 40% of the global economy. Now, without the U.S., TPP covers about 13% of the global economy. I think the big difference is the leadership, right? RCEP, it's led by China. TPP was a U.S.-led initiative.
That did not include China, by the way.
And did not include China, exactly. And some actually consider that this RCEP is really a less restrictive version of the TPP because it's so weak on labor, human rights, and environmental protections.
We should note that India is not getting on board with the RCEP, but also that the U.S. Secretary of Commerce, Wilbur Ross, is calling this a very low-grade treaty. What does he mean by that?
I think that he means that anything that the U.S. is not involved in when it comes to the global economic chain is low grade. I'm not sure that that's the case. So let's just do India for a second. You know, India, which is a big economy, the third largest of these economies in this pact after China and Japan, India is worried that the agreement, which does require the gradual elimination of tariffs, will open up India's domestic markets to a flood of cheap Chinese goods and agricultural produce from Australia and New Zealand. Now, if they can iron out the issues, India could join later, but right now it does not look like India's in this deal.
That is Jill Schlesinger, business analyst with CBS News and host of Jill on Money. Thank you.
Thank you.
We are now less than a year away from the presidential election and about 3 months away from the Iowa caucuses. There's a new poll out today from the New York Times Upshot and Siena College that shows former Vice President Joe Biden leading President Trump by between 2 and 5 points in Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, Florida, and Arizona, all states that President Trump won in 2016. The poll also finds that no other Democrat does as well as Biden against the president in those states. Joining us now to talk about this and more is NPR's Scott Detrow, who covers the campaign and co-hosts the NPR Politics podcast. Hi, Scott.
Hey there.
So Biden looking better in a general election, but a poll last week has him in fourth in Iowa, which is, of course, the first place where there's voting in the Democratic primary campaign and can be very important to build momentum and get the nomination. Biden's campaign manager says Biden doesn't need to win Iowa. Is that true?
It's true, but I think it would give big problems to Joe Biden, and here's why. He has pitched himself over and over again as the candidate who can best beat Donald Trump. That is a core part of Joe Biden's pitch to be the Democratic nominee, along with restoring some normalcy to the presidency, is how he frames it. I think the problem with running as the most electable candidate is that it's a subjective thing and it's something that easily changes. You know, let's go back to the summer. Remember when Kamala Harris really went after Joe Biden in that first debate and briefly gained a lot of ground? Joe Biden briefly lost a lot of support in the couple polls after that. And a lot of people thought it was because he showed himself to be momentarily vulnerable. People were thinking, wow, if he gets attacked like that, how will he get attacked against Donald Trump? Biden, of course, quickly bounced back. But the thinking is,
If you are arguing you are the most electable candidate and you do not win the first contest and you do not win the second contest in New Hampshire, then you're banking on the third contest or later to start mounting victories, you are at real risk for losing momentum.
And by the way, the reason why people think that he may not win the second contest in New Hampshire is in part because he's up against Elizabeth Warren from neighboring Massachusetts and Bernie Sanders from neighboring Vermont. So they've been at the top of the polls in New Hampshire so far.
Yeah, and historically, New Hampshire really does give a big benefit to neighbors. I mean, remember 3 years ago, Bernie Sanders really trounced Hillary Clinton in New Hampshire. Of course, Hillary Clinton is a good counterpoint to what I was saying about Biden. She only narrowly won Iowa by the smallest of small margins against Bernie Sanders. He really dominated the New Hampshire primary. She had to wait for South Carolina for that first big declarative victory. And of course, she went on to win the nomination by a wide margin.
But after a long campaign and a lot of states that we had to go through before she got there.
Through June.
What about Biden, though? He is doing well, as we said, in the national polls. Do you think he's still benefiting from name recognition?
You know, I think it's a mix of name recognition. You know, it's hard to say exactly because we've had a lot of these candidates running for almost a year now. But of course, a good chunk of the country is not paying attention to the blow by blow of the Democratic primary. I think we'll get a good test how much of this is name ID and how much of this is real support for his campaign over the next few months. More and more campaigns are on the airwaves now in these early states, and we're starting to see the candidates actually go directly after each other on the debate stage and a little bit in ads. So, you know, a month from now, when all the top candidates are airing ads, really getting their message out and really drawing sharp contrasts, if there's a notable shift in the polls, I think we can say, well, maybe it was just name ID. But I've got to say, a lot of people have expected Joe Biden to fade in the polls over and over and over again since he got in the race this spring. And by and large, he still hasn't, though a few notable polls in the last week have suggested things are changing a little bit.
Okay, well, let's listen to what we would probably call at this point the top four candidates who held their fall fundraiser along with Iowa Democrats in Des Moines on Friday. The event is considered the beginning of the last leg of the race before the caucuses in Iowa. And this is what the top four candidates, according to the polls, had to say, starting with Biden.
I'm so tired of Democrats and Republicans, independents walking around with their heads down like, woe is me, what are we going to do? The first thing we have to do is get rid of Donald Trump, get him out of office. And once that happens, the road is clear for significant change.
And anyone who comes on this stage and tells you to dream small and give up early is not going to lead our party to victory.
The Democratic Party must become the party of the working class of this country. Not of super PACs, not of corporate interests, not of their lobbyists.
I'm here to launch the era that must come next. Because in order to win and in order to lead, it's going to take a lot more than the political warfare we've come to accept from Washington, D.C.
Pete Buttigieg there. We also heard from Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren, and Joe Biden. Scott, what's standing out to you about what's happening right now in Iowa?
There are two huge contrasts being played out in this race. One is a contrast on policy, go big versus go more incremental. That's what Elizabeth Warren was spelling out right there. Of course, the incremental approaches here, you really have to put that in quotation marks because the, quote, incremental, quote, moderate candidates are all running on platforms remarkably to the left of the last Democratic president, Barack Obama. Joe Biden's health care plan, Pete Buttigieg's health care plan, just as one example, far more progressive than what the Obama administration was able to get signed into law. So you've got the policy differences. Then you've got the generational differences. Pete Buttigieg making that pitch right there. It is so notable. He is in his late 30s And the other three top candidates in the race are all U.S. senators or former vice presidents in their 70s. It's an enormous generational gap in this race.
And Buttigieg is from the Midwest, and the other three are from the Northeast, which is also an interesting difference. Is there time for any of the other candidates who are polling, you know, 5% or below at this point? Is it time for them to break into the top tier?
There is time left, but I think that movement needs to start happening right away. I mean, Buttigieg is a good example. Early summer, late spring, he was the hot candidate. He was getting all the national media profiles. He was getting all the buzz. And he raised a ton of money, but over the course of the summer, he faded in those national polls. He often wasn't within the shot when you talked about the top candidates in the race. But what he was doing was steadily building an organization in Iowa specifically and laying the groundwork to hop back into the top tier of this race. I think there's still space for some candidates to get back in the race, into the conversation, but they have to have those regional offices. They have to have those volunteers on the ground. They have to have a foundation laid. And when you talk about it that way, I think there's really only a handful of candidates who could be in the conversation.
Scott, when you look at the calendar coming up here, we said 3 months to Iowa, but in between that is Thanksgiving and Christmas and New Year's. And there's this impeachment inquiry going on. Based on what they're saying, it could be a couple more weeks before there are public hearings and then maybe a vote and then maybe a trial. How does this all play into the presidential campaign?
In a really interesting way, I just did a story. I talked to a lot of consultants for campaigns that had won Iowa in the past. Here's what everyone in Washington is thinking. We're not sure when there would be a vote on articles of impeachment, but a lot of people assume it could be toward the end of the year, around the holidays. That would set up a Senate trial in January. That trial could last weeks. That trial could be up to 6 days a week, according to what Mitch McConnell, the majority leader, has telegraphed. That means the six senators running for president, including two of the frontrunners, Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders, would not really be able to campaign in the final weeks before Iowa. They would be in Washington at a Senate trial, acting as jurors every single day, except maybe one day they can rush to Iowa and back and then get back to Washington. That is something that is unprecedented in terms of tying up a candidate before a key election. And every consultant I talked to, from the Cruz campaign, from the Obama campaign, from Rick Santorum's campaign, had no idea how you get around that, how you fix the problem of just not having a candidate able to campaign.
And does Mitch McConnell, the Republican leader of the Senate, have control over that, over when they would have the trial and how many days a week it would be, et cetera?
Yes, but it's complicated, and we only really have the Clinton impeachment trial to go off of. I mean, there's Andrew Johnson, but that was, 150 plus
you weren't
years
covering
ago.
That one. Right.
We were not. NPR was not on the air just yet. I think the question is, Mitch McConnell can set the ground rules. There would have to be a lot of agreement with Chuck Schumer, the minority leader. But at a certain point, Chief Justice John Roberts will have a say, too.
Right. NPR's Scott Detrow covering the 2020 presidential race. Scott, thank you.
Thank you.
If you think job interviews are stressful, think about what it would be like to have a computer using artificial intelligence to evaluate you. That's the idea behind a recruiting technology company called HireVue, which uses AI to analyze the faces of job candidates.
The way they do that is by modeling the face with a certain set of points and detect the motion. So for example, if someone's blinking a lot, that's an example of someone being potentially nervous.
That's Ash Kumar, a consultant and former software engineer who has worked on AI and hiring. He does not work for HireVue. But we wanted to take a closer look at some of the claims HireVue is making about its offerings and how their technology actually works. Drew Harwell is a reporter covering artificial intelligence for The Washington Post, and he's been writing about HireVue. Welcome, Drew.
Hey, thank you.
So first, can you explain more how employers are using HireVue and why they're using it?
So these companies get a ton of resumes and applications, and instead of having a human hiring manager actually meet with everyone, they send a link to these job candidates. And when they click that link, it opens up their camera, and they're expected to talk for about 15 to 30 minutes, answering a couple of questions. And all the while, they're being analyzed by this HireVue algorithm. it's looking at the movements on their face, their expression, if they're smiling or frowning. It's processing the sound of their voice, the tone and pitch, and it's looking at the words they choose to say. And then at the end of this process, HireVue spits out a computer-generated report card on every candidate that gives them an employability score and estimates whether they would be a good fit for the job.
HireVue does not disclose its algorithm, but there have been a lot of concerns about how the technology decides what makes someone employable. Here is Ash Kumar again.
The real questions that come up are, how do they account for gender differences? How do they account for cultural differences? Like in certain cultures, nodding your head sideways can mean acknowledgement versus in others, it means no.
Drew, what does HireVue say about how it evaluates people across maybe gender and racial and really cultural lines?
So their argument is that, one, they care about not being discriminatory, and two, that the things they look at are deeper than the color of someone's skin or someone's gender. But I think that concern is a big one because, you know, I talked to a neuroscientist who's studied, do we all show the same sort of facial movements when we're happy or sad? And the truth is we don't. And so there's no sort of perfect baseline for employability.
Yeah, and we actually have a statement from HireVue. The company says this all actually removes bias, as you said, from the hiring process. And they say, quote, their customers have increased the diversity of their new hires by upwards of 55% in 1 year. Based on your reporting, have you found this to be true? Has it increased diversity?
Yeah, some of the companies I talked to did say they had a better, more inclusive pool of people who were passing the first round interview, which I found really interesting. Human interviewing is pretty problematic on its own, right? You know, human recruiters often tend to pick out people who look or sound like them. And so I think that's encouraging to hear that there is more of a diverse kind of hiring pool coming in. But I think the worry is that we're switching out one set of biases for another. These systems may have an objective way of measuring the tenor of our voice, but they're not necessarily objective because they're instructed on what the model employee looks like based off of the employees that came before it. And so they're going to be looking for measurements tailored to a set of people that's not necessarily the perfect employee, but they're just the ones that they have data on.
How widespread is this technology? Do you expect more companies to start using AI in hiring?
I do, actually, because, you know, right now they're used by more than 100 companies. They just got a huge investment from a private equity firm with the intention to expand it, not just into other countries, but into other industries. And I think the worry from some of these AI researchers is that we don't really have a sense that this is scientifically backed.
It's been called pseudoscience by many.
Yeah. And other people also sort of compare it to phrenology, right? Which is this, you know, 20th and 19th century art of expecting we can tell somebody's intellect from how their head is shaped or their face looks. You know, people are worried that, like, we're bringing back all of these old ideas of being able to look at somebody, maybe even stereotype people and estimate their performance or their behavior. And, you know, I think the tools we have allow us to do that in a much more technologically robust way. But I think the doubts there are really real. And I think companies should be careful about the data they're looking at from these.
Drew Harwell, reporter covering artificial intelligence for The Washington Post. Thank you so much, Drew, for joining us.
Thank you.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.